Hi, it's Chad, and you may have noticed that this is a shorter podcast interview. We're still doing the full 60-minute interviews, but with the private membership that we have going, we're reserving the last half of the interview for questions specifically for membership. We're full this year, but we will be opening up more spots in 2025. So if you want to stay on top of that, please head over to our website, industrialize.com, and fill out your name and we'll add you to the waiting list. Thanks for tuning in. We really appreciate your support. Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm very excited for another episode of the Industrial Real Estate Show, and I'm honored to be joined by a member of the Industrial Insiders community. His name is Ori, and he's the Director of Acquisitions for Box Equities, and they own about 5 million square feet worth of industrial real estate all across North America. And I'm excited to chat with him today, specifically about their investment strategy, how they look at deals, how they identify markets, but also a topic called middle mile logistics, which I think is going to be a very fascinating topic to explore. And he's got a lot to say on it. So I'm very excited to be welcome Ori. So I'm very curious just to dive into this more and get your insights into how you guys identify markets, labor obviously being a key one, which isn't talked about enough. I really like that component of it. But let's start there. So how do you do your site selection first? And I'm thinking more from a geography standpoint on perhaps it's a state level, perhaps it's a city level. How do you determine what markets you want to be in?
Sure. So in the end of the day, we are real estate guys. Let's start there. So I think the fundamentals of real estate and sort of the more traditional metrics are important to us, right? Population growth, job growth. And so you start there. So those are regions of focus and the highway. Let's just talk about the highway for a second. I think most people in real estate, location, 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 what can't you replicate? You can't replace the highway infrastructure. I guess until the day supply chain comes off the highway, I think, which is a bet and conversation in and of itself. But as long as we're on the highways, let's start looking at the major interstates where freight is active. So we start there. We then identify the population centers and some of the more traditional metrics of real estate. And then we start identifying paths of growth between those two and, you know, markets that are needed to serve both. For example, if you think about Savannah as the port and you think about Atlanta as a population center, what about the middle mile that goes from Savannah to Atlanta? And so the highways that connect those two, right? You're going to need a port. That port is growing at a rapid pace. And think about Atlanta as the population center and the labor growth there and the population growth there, right? That's a clear place to invest from all asset classes. How do we now look at different areas that are serving both of those that need to be on that middle mile going all the way to the last mile and into Atlanta? So that's just one example of a way how we're thinking about it. I think, Chad, you and I have talked about the border of Mexico and Texas, right? So we're now saying, okay, that there's a big transition there, right? The reallocation of supply chain, the onshoring, things are going to start moving over there. Now let's look at a highway that's going to experience growth from that border to the population centers, where are the major highways, where the freight is really going to be active. And so I'd say the two biggest drivers we're looking at is the highway and then the labor. Once you focus on the highway connecting those two points, labor becomes one of the biggest things. Is if I'm going to set up an operation, I want to make sure that there's two things when it comes to labor. I think that's really important. Obviously, the cost of labor. And cost is more of not just their weekly or monthly wage. It's the loyalty of that labor, right? That they're going to stay, they're not going to leave. They've been working at places for a very long time. And then the second thing is the supply of that labor. So we spend a lot of time understanding the supply of a particular market. Is this a manufacturing labor hub? Have people been working for a very long time in skilled manufacturing? They can shift over to a different industry. So those are two real things we focus on. And then once we pick locations, you know, that's really how we identify a market. And, you know, to date, I think most of the markets that we look at, we've identified a second acquisition within those markets. So I guess that those are the two main drivers we're looking at when we identify certain areas of investment.
Yeah, it's so simple yet profound, because I think a lot of people might skip over those. And like you said, you're real estate guys, so you're still looking at other trends, but those are two primary drivers in that. And I do want to dive into what you look for specifically in buildings when you're there. So assuming we the high level site selection. Now you've identified markets you want to be in. What do the buildings actually look like? But even before that, is there a parameters for how big of a city you want to be in, either on an upper limit or a lower limit on population?
So I think more important than just the amount of population, I do think there is certain metrics, but I think industrial clusters is important to us, right? Nodes on a major highway, yet you're one of the five industrial buildings in that particular county or city or node, that's extremely limited. That's a place where we'd be pretty scared. Yet if there's a smaller city, I mean, most people, I'm just thinking of smaller cities that we've come across or smaller areas that we've come across that most people don't talk about. I mean, who knew that Findlay, Ohio, I don't know for anyone who's on the phone, Findlay, Ohio probably has at least 15 of the Fortune 200 huge big box distribution centers. If you talked about anyone investing in real estate in across any asset classes, most people would know Findlay, Ohio. We have not invested in Findlay, Ohio, but that's a perfect example of, it's a major industrial cluster, right? Tons of companies have located there. So I'd say we start there. At a more micro level with the property, going back to the major fundamentals of real estate investment, we want to have optionality of tenanting to multiple uses. We're not solely focused on a manufacturing operation or a distribution operation. At the end of the day, we want functional real estate, clean rectangles, clear height is important to us. Should a tenant ever vacate, we want the ability to, you know, be at the top of the totem pole of re-tenanting that space. So that, you know, that's what we sort of look at when it comes to the actual micro asset study.
What would be some areas of a building that would be a concern or perhaps a non-starter for you? So property comes across your desk and you're just going through the preliminary stage on it. Is there anything that stands out as something that would be an immediate no just because of an element to that building?
Well, most people, when we talk about industrial real estate and the biggest risk, and I think I've even seen some content that you've produced on your fantastic Twitter feed of what's industrial's biggest risk. And I'd say there's a lot of unknowns out there, but I'd say the biggest one that's probably easy to identify is functional obsolescence, right? Is your building going to be obsolete in comparison to what they're using it for in the future? And so non-starters for sure are buildings that we feel can't capture a significant amount of tenancy. So if it's not a clean rectangle, if there's something specialized, you know, two-story, it's got this, you know, funky type of L shape and then a box shape, right? Those are certain things. I think what's important, what we've noticed with a lot of tenant requirements is, you know, look at where clear heights have gone. I mean, in different markets, you're at 32, 36, 40. I think we probably have a bottom line on 22. I think for most of the manufacturing operations, at the very least, that's what they're looking for. Some people aren't really looking for, you know, what's not talked about is the 32 foot clear, 36 foot clear. For the people that need fully HVAC, it costs a lot more to cool a 36 foot clear building than a 22. So we're trying to find that balance, but I'd say below that, clear heights is really important. You know, at a 19, 18 foot clear, you're getting a lot of passes from the tenant market. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else that are complete non-starters at a micro level, but I think I've covered the two biggest ones, at least for us.
So with manufacturing and warehousing attracting different types of tenants, if for no other reason than just the loading, warehouse is typically going to have more dock level doors, manufacturing is going to typically have more grade level doors. And the optionality, I think, is key because there's so much to be said about one tenant leaving. You've got options to fill that with other tenants. How do you decide what the optimal mix is for a building when it comes to grade level loading versus dock doors?
Yeah, honestly, I think aside from the loading, listen, I think we're very basis driven. I think across our portfolio, we're sub $50 a foot for the basis we bought across our portfolio, which is attractive. So on our CapEx in terms of updating facilities, the exact dock load, I think we care more about the ability to add docks or change the way those docks are functioning. It's more of, can we add those docks if need be for that, you know, different type of tenant. I'd say one of the biggest things we're also looking at and adding a lot of value to within our buildings is HVAC. I mean, the amount of tenants in today's, going back to our beginnings and what we tried focusing on within the middle mile and Onshoring was the biggest tailwind that we wanted to get behind, right? Everyone's talked about e-commerce, the last mile. I think the biggest driver of this middle mile is the onshoring. Onshoring from a tenant requirement standpoint is probably one of the, you know, if you're a tenant rep across the country or, you know, leasing rep, almost all the requirements, at least on our end, have been a solar manufacturing company, a manufactured housing company. These are CHIPS Act type requirements. A lot of them are looking for power. A lot of them are looking for HVAC. And they don't want the required imagination of what this space could look like. They want a clean rectangle and they want those few requirements. And then they could say, okay, now we can build out our space. So I think that's how we're envisioning a lot of the necessities of the buildings that we're buying. Regardless of, you know, I think for the most part, our acquisitions are fully tenanted, and we do spend a lot of time making sure that tenant has a mission criticality to that space. We're not really looking for storage units on a major highway. It's more of the really mission critical to the overall operation. So we spend a lot of time on that. But I think that covers, you know, should there be a downside scenario where a tenant were to vacate, how we're envisioning re-tenanting the space.
Do you budget to have costly turnover costs when the tenant does vacate, or does it go back to that earlier premise that you're buying simple boxes, simple rectangles, and you're hoping to find another tenant that moves in? Or how do you allocate CapEx expenses when a tenant does come up?
Yeah, well, it's obviously in our initial underwriting, you have to always underwrite the downside if that happens. A lot of our assets, and I think one of the things that's part of our investment criteria that I haven't mentioned yet, is we really focus on having a mark to market. I like to always say our downside is our upside. Should a tenant ever vacate, that's actually the upside scenario where we can, you know, really mark to market the rent. That's really important to us. So as part of, even though you're budgeting a significant amount of CapEx on the re-tenant, you're also collecting a much higher rent and, you know, marking to market that and, you know, subsequently having a significant capital event, hopefully thereafter. So that's also part of the underwriting and sort of balances each other out.
I want to dive into that a little bit more, because I've said numerous times myself that that is the biggest risk with industrial real estate, is that downside risk. And it's not fully appreciated all the time. I think big sophisticated owners and groups like yourself will do it. But I think first time investors, someone considering getting into industrial real estate, or perhaps a broker working with a first time investor, they don't fully appreciate that downside risk. And that can be the difference between not only even a good and a great investment, it could be the difference between a good and a tragic investment that perhaps wipes out all the equity. So I want to just get more of your thoughts onto that. How do you underwrite that downside risk when you're evaluating a property?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's talked about that should be your main focus within all investing. I mean, if you're buying something that's tenanted already, it's a very easy thing to underwrite the upside on them staying and then paying rent. The downside is the whole underwriting. I think going just back to our part of our main investment criteria, we need to have a significant mark to market. That means that the current rent is significantly below market, that should you ever have a vacate, the re-tenanting is still in a very attractive business plan. Again, that also lends itself to understanding the market. Should you vacate, you have to look at the fundamentals of the market. I mean, Chad, you and I have sort of discussed offline, there are definitely some markets you're starting to see some overbuilt product. Do you want to have a dark space that's Class B? I mean, we're talking about the second gen type stuff versus brand new assets. Do you want to have a, you know, a vacate scenario in a market that now has a significant amount of newer supply? So you have to think about that. You have to, you know, we've been avoiding that type of stuff because we are nervous about that downside. Even if there is a mark to market, you know, are you going to get the tenant requirements you want when you've got a significant amount of new supply just trying to get them into the door today? And so there are those markets. You have to be aware of that in today's day. But again, if the market is significantly tight, there's not too much availability, and that vacate scenario happens, yeah, the underwriting requires a, you know, significant CapEx, but hopefully you get that tenant to come in and pay the rent that you underwrote from the beginning.
That was such a profound way of describing something I believe so fundamentally. And I'm going to use that clip numerous times on what you just said, because I couldn't agree more with everything that you said. And it really emphasizes to me the difference between smart money, groups like yourself, and dumb money. And that could be called somebody that owns a couple of houses and then decides they want to go and buy an industrial building. And smart money says, okay, we're going to underwrite our downside risk, but we're also going to look to see, as you said, the downside risk could actually be the upside. Because if you have that mark-to-market spread, if a tenant leaves, you actually can contemplate increasing the value of the building. Whereas that dumb money is an investor that goes and pays money for a building where perhaps there's a tenant in there, they have 3 years left on the lease, and the lease rate might actually be higher than what the market is. So now they're in the position that if that tenant leaves, now they might actually have to discount the value of that building by a process of capitalizing new rental income. So I think that is such an important piece with industrial real estate, and that should really form the foundation of what every investor is doing, is underwriting that downside risk. The downside risk is infinitely more important than any projections we can make. And I mean, you and I both know too, you can skew pro formas and make some adjustments 10 years down the road and have your IRR or your cash on cash look whatever you want it to. But that downside risk is key right now. So thanks for explaining that so well. There was a question that came. There's a few questions that came in, and I want to get to one right now just because I think it ties in with that, and then I'll get to the other ones in a bit here. Tom asked, what is a spread you look for when you're doing mark-to-market?
That's a good question. I think it's unique. Typically, you know, capital markets have really moved. It depends which market, depends how, you know, how far out you are. I think just important going back to the middle mile. We put an overall discount on our cap rate in comparison to the major infill markets, right? Typically, we're 100 basis points wide. So we start there. And then that mark to market, we're trying to at least be, you know, 150, 200 basis points spread to that exit cap. Depends on the credit, depends on the amount of term left of that credit. But typically, there needs to be a minimum of that 150 basis point spread is really what we're looking at.
On the on valuation terms, are you seeing much of a difference? And I'm assuming the answer in this is yes, but much of a difference on cap rates between a primary market and a tertiary market?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what's fascinating, I think, in the past 12 months for us is that we've always had the ability to transact even as interest rates have gone up, because in a time where interest rates were at, you know, where they were in 2020, 2021, our cap rates in our markets were probably still 6. Now they've moved to 7, maybe some have moved to 8. But during that time, we've still been able to lever at a positive, in a positive way or neutral way. So transactions are still happening. Whereas if you look at some of the gateway coastal markets where that, you know, those trades were happening in the 3s, the 4s, that movement is now into the 5s, but that's still a negative leverage standpoint, which is creating a lot of struggle to transact. So it's been attractive for us to still remain where the yields where we are, but yeah, 100%. There's been at least an 100 basis point delta between some of the gateway stuff and, you know, some of the areas we're investing.
There's some awesome questions coming in, so I'm going to get to those quickly in a second here. But just quickly, one last question that I have is: where are you most focused on right now? Are there geographical areas, any areas in specific, or is it more opportunity driven? But where are you spending your time right now looking for potential acquisitions?
So we talk a lot about the EV belt, and that's just a main focus of ours. The amount of jobs that are being created through that and through those smaller local communities. So that's really, you know, again, and that's also tied to the existing, going back to the traditional existing fundamentals of the attractive places to invest in real estate. So the Carolinas, Florida, Georgia, Texas is actually a state that we've been trying to play ways into getting into. We just have not been successful. I think you and I have discussed the Laredo, El Paso type areas. It's a gold rush and we haven't been able to be successful there. But these are places, you know, where we're noticing a significant amount of jobs being created through CHIPS Act, EV, and trying to, you know, run on that tailwind through our investments.
Just piggybacking on that, are you in growth acquisition mode right now, or what's the outlook for when you eventually decide to sell a portfolio?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're IRR driven, so sales are always going to be looked at. But for the most part, we're heavy growth mode and we're looking to actually double the footprint in the next year or two.
Oh, wow. So you could take it to 10 million square feet.
Yeah, it's getting quite busy.
Well, I think any brokers on this call should be reaching out to you to start that relationship. Because if you're going to add 5 million square feet, you're going to need some brokers helping you out.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that, Oria. That was fantastic. I loved everything you said on there. And that's a continuation of what you and I were talking about the other day as well. So I think we hit all the key points on there. Was there anything just before, and there's some awesome questions in here too, but was there anything that we didn't cover in the chat that we had that you wanted to bring up first?
No, I think we covered it for the most part. We coined a phrase, I think, you know, maybe we didn't coin it, but when we talk investment committee about the downside that you were talking about, we just call it a melting ice cube. If it's identified as a melting ice cube, it's a pass. Like we said, the mark to market, and if there's a significant mark to market, the downside is the upside. So those are just two quick phrases that we constantly talk about in investment committee. It's a single tenant. You get one shot at this. It's obviously not small bay, shallow bay. There's a lot of different tenants. You can move rents here. You can lose a tenant here. This is single tenant. You spend a lot of time on that tenant. You spend a lot of time on that rent. If you're off 25 cents, 50 cents on what market rent is, it can be the biggest difference in that overall investment.
Melting ice cube. I'm going to steal that and I'm going to attribute it to you guys. I'm going to say that you're the ones that actually came up with it. I love it.
So I don't think we coined it, but we definitely, that's what we talk about a lot.
I love it. I think that's such a great way of describing it. And just so everyone knows too, Ori is part of this membership group as well. So you can connect with him as part of this group. And we'll also circulate his contact information as well after. Tom, another great question he had here. I'm just going to go through these in order. So we might bounce around a little bit here, or hopefully that's okay. Tom asked, are you building these buildings for the location needed or buying existing buildings?
Yeah, we're only buying existing to date. I think we decided that we're a lean team, nimble, and the best way for growth is to simply buy existing than, you know, getting bought in some ground up construction type projects.
Would you do development in the future?
Yeah, it likely is a path of growth for us. Though just that going back to the replacement cost and what we've been able to buy to date, it's sort of hard to envision building at 120 a foot when we're seeing really good quality assets that we can trade in the 50s, 40s, 60s a foot.
Yeah, spot on with that. Marco had a question. I think you identified it as 22 feet, but maybe you can expand on it as well. The minimum height you'd consider functional, and perhaps you could even break that down on, I know you mentioned kind of there's manufacturing that they don't necessarily want to heat or cool all that cubic footage. So how are you guys trying to reconcile what that ideal height is, trying to take into account everyone's different needs?
I'm going to punt this one because it's simply the feedback we kept from the tenants. I don't know why. We've owned an asset sub 22, and the experience in tenanting that space has been a world of a difference versus something that is similar in quality that is 22, and the amount of manufacturing requirements that do come in and say, like, that's just the minimum they've established. And it's not just one tenant that's come by. A lot of them have just been saying that. And then there is that feedback that everyone talks about. I think it's mixed opinion. There's newer manufacturing buildings going up that have that higher clear height, but power is a really big thing and cooling is a really big thing, especially in the Southeast. You have two aspects. You have the machinery that's coming in and you also have the labor, right? If you're in a Southeast state and you've got tons of people working in there, no one, you know, it gets pretty hot in the summer. So everyone's trying to study the amount of power that exists at that facility and then the cost of the utilities to constantly cool that building. So that's a full-blown underwriting that goes in from a tenant requirement when they're looking at your spaces.
Just on that topic, and Adrian, I'm going to get to your question next. Power, I think, is going to be the next big differentiator in buildings. And it's just going to be a function of racking technology, EV technology, Internet of Things, robotics. Everything is just going to be requiring more and more power. When you're looking at these existing buildings, which presumably a good portion of them wouldn't have been built with this increased power consumption being contemplated, how are you determining whether there's enough power or there's the capacity to get enough power, or is that on the radar right now?
It is actually on the radar. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we're buying that the tenant, through their improvements and their stickiness over the years on what they're doing, have actually added tons of power capabilities to the site. And that adds value to us when we're looking at, oh, this, you know, in the retenanting scenario. So that's actually, and I think you guys I think I've come across a tweet of yours where you've talked about that recently, but that is 100% true. And we add a lot of value to that when we're looking for it. And then should it be, you know, on the lower side of its capabilities, that we're going to ding it, we're going to ding the asset for that and put that in the underwriting on, should this ever go dark? One, can we add the power that would be needed? And two, is that going to be something for sure in this particular asset that someone's going to look for?
Are you looking at solar on any of the buildings?
You know, it's funny. We actually had an internal meeting about solar as of yesterday in our company. We've had so many conversations with a lot of solar companies and even operators out of California and New Jersey, where you're seeing a lot of the existing stuff. We just haven't got clarity. We're industrial operators. I think there is the future for that. We just feel that we can be patient enough to really understand all the facts on where this goes before making a bold movement on just putting it across all of our assets. And again, it's state level as well. So depending on where you are is where the interest lies. We've explored it, but I think at this point, we want to just watch as it grows within other states to make sure we're making the right decision.
Yeah, I'd echo that too. I've looked at it on a building that I own on putting some solar on there. I've gone so far as having a solar company come, and they came with their engineers and they determined how many panels they could put on the roof. And the only way it made sense was with a ton of government incentives. And the process of even navigating through those to determine if you can get those incentives is murky at best. Depends how much they've actually already committed. Depends if they can generate enough power on your roof. So it's not an easy transition, as you were saying. Like it's much more complex than just saying, okay, well, let's put some solar on there, tie into the grid, sell anything that we're not using back to the grid, and everyone wins. It's much more complex than that.
Absolutely.
And
I think we're at the liberty to be patient with it and just see where this goes. Not to say we're absolutely not against it, and I think it is a big thing to talk about in the future. It's more of, you know, for our existing footprint right now, where we are located, let's be patient. Let's watch how other states and other landlords and even tenants, you know, how they're reactive to this movement. And then we make a decision based on that.
Yeah, great answer. Sorry, it was Avedan who had the next question. And this is a great question. I think everybody struggles with this. What's your process to assess market rents?
We spend a lot of time. So data is probably the biggest thing we've invested in to date. We've built out our own proprietary system. I think because we've only focused on one niche and one asset class, you have the ability to really just focus on that streamline of data and clean that data and be obsessed with that data. So we now have thousands of data points within our system. We use a company called DealPath, owned by Blackstone. We built out our own proprietary system behind that. And now we're simply tracking every rent that comes across the table. And then not only that, we don't rely on that. We rely on our leasing broker community. We like to see who's the most active in the space in that particular market. And we spend a lot of time talking to them on the exact asset, the market. It's such a great question because it's all the difference in your underwriting. You could be 25, 50 cents a foot off. That makes all the difference. So I guess that answer is twofold: data and then also our leasing broker community.
I love the point you made about being obsessed with the data, because that's what it takes. It actually takes almost like a neurotic level of commitment to just, you hear about a deal and you're like, I just have to know what's going on. Like I have to know more about it.
So we're cleaning data constantly. My acquisition associates just looking through spreadsheets and identifying, do we have this comp already? If we have this comp, is it the comp that we had in the system lining up with what we have now? Sometimes it's not, and we're calling the broker and saying, wait a second, I've got something saying $6 a foot and I'm seeing something that says $6.25 a foot. What happens here? So yeah, we're obsessed is the right word, because that's really the truth.
Love it. Anthony has a question. Do you buy with asset level financing? And two-part question, how does the rate environment factor into your underwriting?
Yeah, I mean, it's significant. We lever at the property level. We're not fund oriented. though that's in talks for the future. So everything's as a one-off. We have great relationships with regional banks, LifeCos and CMBS, so all the full gamut, but significantly alters, again, going back to it, single tenant, right? You have one tenant, you have one business plan. So if that business plan includes financing, financing is constantly affecting the way you're underwriting. But to date, you know, most mortgage brokers will tell you the money that needs to be invested on the debt side, almost all of it wants to go into industrial. So there's no shortage of liquidity. It's just trying to pair the right lender with the right asset.
Ori, thank you so much, my man.
Thank you.